From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm in from San Francisco for her. On this edition of Fresh Air, we hear from Stan Freberg, who made television just a bit more bearable for us in the 60s and 70s. Freberg's responsible for some of the funniest and most innovative commercials in television history. But he's also done radio, comedy albums, and now he's written his autobiography. We meet Stan Freberg on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, we talk with reporter-turned-novelist Ward Just. He's drawn on his years covering national affairs for the Washington Post in his latest political novel, Jack Gantz. Rock historian Ed Ward examines the sights and sounds of the mod movement. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest detective novel from Scottish writer Michael Dibdin. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. My guest today, Stan Freberg, is a satirical writer. He's applied his talent to radio, cartoons, comedy records, and advertising. He got his start in show business doing voices for Warner Brothers cartoons fresh out of high school and played bit parts for Jack Benny's radio show. His comedy records have featured parodies of 50s and 60s songs, including Day-O and Heartbreak Hotel. He spoofed radio soap operas with his steamy John and Marcia routine, in which he performed both roles. Freberg's offbeat humor on recordings attracted an imaginative advertiser who urged Freberg to write some commercials. Some of them are now classics, including his ad for Sunsweet Prunes, Today the Pits, Tomorrow the Wrinkles, and his 9 out of 10 doctors prefer Chungking foods. Stan Freberg says he was born between the NBC chimes and a Rinso commercial as a Leo, with Lever Brothers his rising sign. He kept his ear close to his old Atwater Kent radio as a boy, and he wrote, produced, and starred in his own high school productions. He still writes and produces his own commercials. Today, his ad firm boasts the motto, Ars Gratia Pecuniae, Art for Money's Sake. Freberg's new autobiography is called It Only Hurts When I Laugh, which covers his career up to the early 60s. He told me how he first swept into the advertising racket from his comedy work.
Oh, I had an entire other career for many years before I ever came, you know, within 1,000 miles of Madison Avenue. That's right. The man that hired me was a fan of the records that I'd made, and, you know, I'd sold millions of records on Capitol, had a radio show on the CBS radio network, et cetera. And this man who was in San Francisco wanted some commercials that he thought, where he thought humor might work, and there was so little humor in advertising as to not even be noticed. And that was like the ice age of humor in advertising. There wasn't any, really. And so he liked the way I used humor for the ear, which, of course, was radio, and records was radio. Radio and records are interchangeable to me because they're all created for the medium of the ear and therefore the theater of the mind. And so the first thing I did, was fortunately, it worked at the point of sale, and I was hailed as some kind of new hero in certain quarters. Other quarters wrote me off as a nut, and they thought the whole thing was a fluke that could never happen again.
This was an ad for Contadina tomato paste.
Right.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
Could you explain a bit about what was going on at that time in the tomato paste industry and why they sought you out?
Yeah, in the tomato paste biz,
yeah.
Yes. Well, the Hunt's company had suddenly, the giant Hunt's people had invaded this very private, vertical, narrow field of a loyal following of Italian people as well as other people who like to make tomato sauce and spaghetti. And the Contadina family panicked. Actually, it was the Morisi family who owned it, and they didn't know what to do. So they had this agency, Cunningham & Walsh, in San Francisco. And this man, Howard Gossage, was a fan, said, do whatever you want. And I said, well, I don't want to do normal advertising. I'm not interested unless I can do it my way, because I thought for years that I wish somebody would create advertising for me the way I, wish they would. So now I would now be able to create advertising for other people the way I wished other people had created it for me. Since I was the consumer I knew best, I created it mainly for myself, which is the only true position that any artist can take. I have on my desk at home a little saying that by E.B. White that says that the true writer plays to an audience of one.
So, what you came up with a slogan then?
Well, it was more than a slogan. It was a jingle that went, who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? Who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? Who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? You know who, you know who, you know who. No mention of the client. A long, embarrassing pause, and the announcer said, in case you don't, it's Contadina tomato paste. But then I did this other commercial that led into that, and do we have time for me to recreate it out of my memory pen? We'll hope for the best here. It was the two men standing on top of the Empire State Building, and I played the older man. I said, all right, you got it straight what we want you to do now? The man said, I think so. You want me to take down this tower here on top of the Empire State Building, put up a 500-foot can of Contadina tomato paste? The man said, that's right. And the guy says, but that tower was put there to moor Zeppelins, too. I mean, I said, look, how many Zeppelins have moored there in the last week? He says, well, not too many, that's right. He says, I know, but well, I could be arrested. He says, all right, you want me to get another contract or is that? He says, no, go ahead. He says, all right, now don't forget to have the can blink day and night. The words, there are many delicious uses for Contadina tomato paste. The man says, I thought you wanted it to blink, who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? I said, oh, yeah. He says, well, which do you want? I said, well, let me sleep on it, okay? Okay. That was it.
And the clients, most of them, hated it.
They all, yes. The agency hated it, followed by the people at the marketing level of the client hated it because it didn't sound like real advertising. It sounded like some strange little off-the-wall conversation, entertainment, you know. But the president of Contadina, Marty Morisi, loved it. Years later, after it worked to an alarming degree, he said, it didn't sound like real advertising to me. That's what I liked about it. And I figured that everybody was up to their earlobes in real advertising, so if I created something that didn't sound like advertising, I might have a chance to communicate. That was my theory, and I proved it almost immediately, and I've been doing it ever since that year, which is 1956.
My guest is Stan Freberg. Your entrance into advertising was in some ways a fluke. Some guy liked what you were doing, thought it was funny, thought it would work. In many ways, your whole approach into the world of advertising and radio was in part a fluke, but in part also a result of skill. I mean, you took the bus into Hollywood one day looking for some work and thought you'd get off right in the middle of Hollywood and get a job, which, of course, is what a lot of people think they can do, but you did it.
Well, this is the first time I ever took the bus into Hollywood by myself. I was only barely 18 years old. This is right after I graduated from high school, and you're right, it was an amazing thing. And, you know, maybe God led me into this strange old building, and I saw a talent agent, the stars of tomorrow, you know. I walked in and auditioned for these people, and the woman immediately picked up the phone and dialed a man at Warner Brothers Cartoons, arranged an audition for me the next day. I went in, did a lot of voices. You know, this is just having come in on the bus again. And now this man says, terrific, can you come back tomorrow and do this for some of our directors? And so I go back home to Pasadena on the bus, lay awake all night, you know, while visions of Looney Tunes danced in my head, you know.
What were the voices you did for your audition?
Oh, all kinds of things. I did Franklin Roosevelt, you know, yesterday, December 7th, a date that will live in infamy. Oh, okay, then I did everybody wants to get into the act, you know, Jimmy Durante. And Peter Lorre, I did voices like that. I did kind of strange voice like that, you know. Anyhow, I auditioned for all these directors. We're on the other side of this black curtain, and I'm back there trembling in my shoes at a mic. Finally, this nice gentleman named John Burton, who ran Warner Brothers Cartoons for Leon Schlesinger, led me out and introduced me to all these guys, and they all came up. They were really nice, sweet to me. Chuck Jones put his arm around me and said, I'll figure out a way to use you. And he, of course, was one of the fathers of Bugs Bunny. And the Roadrunner, mainly the coyote and the Roadrunner. And Bob Clampett came up and said, I just decided to have this little Scotty dog in a new cartoon talk like FDR, so I'll have you do Roosevelt.
I understand that you had to get special permission from the White House to do FDR's voice.
You did, that's right. In those days, anybody impersonating Roosevelt had a right to the White House or send a tape. We sent an acetate disc, their magnetic recording tape having not been invented yet. The Germans had invented, but we hadn't figured that out yet. And the Germans invented wire recorders also. But we'll discuss that on another special on the history of recording devices.
But the recording devices were something that fascinated you. I mean, you had a great deal of fun with the technology and making a lot of your parody records. And I'd like to play just a bit of one now that was
sure.
inspired by Elvis Presley.
Thank you.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, Heartbreak Hotel. Well, I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely, I could die. Could I have a little more echo on my voice?
I love that, to have a little more echo on your voice.
A little more echo on my voice, yeah. I, of course, was kidding around with the fact that Elvis did have a lot of echo, and it helped create his audio persona, you know. And he had a little problem when he went out and did personals because he didn't have a built-in echo chamber yet. That technology was to come later on. So rock stars now, they it comes in a little box. You can just have any echo. You don't have to go into a giant echo room. But the way he moved his hips around, nobody noticed whether he had echo or not, and everybody was screaming so loud they couldn't have heard it if he had it when he did live appearances. You know.
The orchestra that you often worked with on some of your parody records, Billy May and his orchestra, had some fine studio musicians in it. And I understand some of the musicians you worked with include Laurent Almeida and a young Glenn Campbell.
Yeah, young Glenn Campbell is right. He played 12-string guitar on number of records, especially the Banana Boat song, Day-O, that I did. And he was a quiet, shy kid with long blonde hair, and he was yet to be discovered, but he was a terrific 12-string guitar player. My gosh, he was great. And Lorenzo Almeida was a marvelous classical guitarist who had his own recording contract with Capitol. He was like Segovia, you know. And so I used him on the Banana Boat song, too. My contractor, who was a woman named Dopey Klein.
This was the woman who put together your studio musicians.
Yeah, uh-huh. she would call various people, and the first time I used Glenn Campbell, she said, "I got a new guitar player for you. This plays terrific 12-string. His name is Glenn Campbell. You're going to like him." And then she said, "I couldn't find a rhythm guitar player that I'm happy with, so I got you Lorenzo Almeida." I said, "Are you kidding? He wouldn't work on a record of mine. The man is a classical." She said, "Oh, he's a big fan of yours. He'd love it. He thought he'd have the time of his life." And he did, and that was the Banana Boat session.
My guest is Stan Freberg. He's the creator of some of this country's most memorable commercials. He often acts in them also, playing several different characters. Freberg made several comedy albums in the 1960s and began his career in radio, working in other shows, including the Jack Benny radio show. He's written the first part of his autobiography. It's titled It Only Hurts When I Laugh. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Stan Freberg. I remember a commercial that you worked on in the 1970s for the McGovern-Hatfield bill that would have cut off all funding to Southeast Asia, try to end the war in Vietnam. Was that, for you, one of the first examples of issue-oriented campaign spot?
Yeah, that's probably the only issue-oriented campaign that I ever did. I've never done any political advertising, and I think that basically satirists ought to stay not apolitical, but certainly bipartisan and stand in the middle and swing both ways, you know. My friend Mort Saul got into trouble one time because the Kennedys thought that simply because he had attacked, or not attacked, but made jokes about the Eisenhower administration, that he surely would only continue to throw barbs at Republicans, and then they were quite surprised when he began making jokes on the Kennedy administration.
Equal opportunity jokester.
Yes, that's what he was. But Mort claims he fell from favor for a while with Jack Kennedy. But in the end, though, they were all friendly, I guess. But this, the McGovern-Hatfield, I'm amazed that you remember that, because I did not write about that in this book. I'm saving that for the next book. I'm going to tell the whole inside story about that, which will be quite revealing and astonishing story.
Well, I remember that. Weren't you broken in by the plumbers at the time, the sort of the Nixon plumbers?
Yeah, that's right, yes. But I'd rather not talk any more about that at this time. For one thing, I'd like to get out of Washington alive. And
oh, come on. You can say things on radio that don't have to yet appear in print.
No, yeah, that's right. No, that's I was broken into. How do you happen to know about that, Sedge?
We have a very fine research staff here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I remember some of these also from the time.
Uh-huh. They have a very fine tap into my phone at home in Beverly Hills.
No phone taps. No phone taps. All public information.
It is public information, but I mean, I haven't really gone on official record about that, but I will talk about that in the next book. Yeah.
Which you expect out when?
A little over a year it'll be out. It's in my word processor now, a little over half done, and you see, the reason I didn't talk about it in this book is I did that in 1970 or 71, I think it was, 71 perhaps. And that was when McGovern and Hatfield were trying to legislate us out of Vietnam. The Congress would have cut off all funding to Southeast Asia. And when the money stopped, man, the war would have stopped. And that's about it, would have been it. And we just missed by about three votes, three more senatorial votes, and we would have been out of there. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I did these spots, which were funded by public money. I donated my time, by the way. They paid for the production of it, is all.
What sort of arrangements do you ask for when somebody says, we'd like to hire you?
Well, I'd rather not discuss my fee, but it's not paltry. But I've often said that when people ask, well, how much does it cost to hire you? I say, more than you think, but not as much as you might imagine.
How about conditions? Are people then required? You give them a campaign and they have to take that?
First of all, let me tell you this. I don't take on everybody that comes to me. I fortunately, God willing, I've been able to be kind of selective now at this point in my career. And so if the thing interests me, if it's a terrible product, I wouldn't take it on for money in a Swiss bank account. So I have to believe in the product more or less. And then I have to be challenged by some problem that exists. You know, I turned down the Tide account for Procter & Gamble one time because they said, well, we can articulate our problem. And they were in my office in Hollywood, and they said, here's our problem. We have 72% of the detergent market, and we'd like to increase our share of market. I said, no, good, piggy. There's enough detergent backing up in the sinks and bathrooms of America, you know. But assuming that I like the product, I want to help them, then they pay me X dollars in front to address this problem. And then at some point, I now read them the script. If they like it, which they usually do, maybe a couple small minor changes for technically correct lines, and then we go forward into production, and that's it. And then they pay the production and the rest of my fee. And the only requirement is that I shall decide what is or what is not funny. I finally wrote that clause in after years of being sick of explaining to clients what was funny about certain things. That if you have to explain it, you know, a guy with the Salada Tea Company in Boston, Massachusetts, said to me, can you change chicken soup to something else? I said, no, I can't. He said, well, what's funny about chicken soup? I said, if you have to ask, you'll never understand. It's just funny. Chicken soup is funny.
My guest is Stan Freberg here on Fresh Air. A couple of your most successful commercials, and in fact, one of your parody records. This is Stan Freberg Presents the USA record. You had a song called Take an Indian to Lunch.
Yeah.
Which was poking fun of wishy-washy liberals at the time.
Yeah,
you
also stuffed shirt liberals stuffed is shirt the liberals. Way. I
And about. Your advertisement for Chungking Chinese food said 9 out of 10 doctors recommend, and you see a shot of 9 Oriental doctors and 1 Caucasian. is this nowadays? Would you feel that these ads might be verging into racist in subject, or would you tend to shy away from ethnic use in your ads?
No, not at all, not at all, because I certainly wasn't making fun of any ethnic race. I mean, that 9 out of 10 doctors recommend Chungking chow mein. If there's any, and 9 out of 10 doctors are Chinese in their white coats and stethoscopes, if there are any Chinese people that don't think that's funny, they'll have to go to bed without any egg rolls. I'm sorry.
I understand that Jack Parr quizzed you once about the take an Indian to lunch and wondered whether you ever had, and you invited any Indian who was watching to show up for lunch with you the next day?
Right into the camera. I said on The Tonight Show, any Indians within the sound of my voice, come to my hotel tomorrow and I'll take you to lunch. And he said, which hotel? And I said, appropriately, the Algonquin. And the next day, 26 Indians showed up and cheered as I entered the lobby. Some of them were in ceremonial costumes, and one woman had a papoose on her back and a little carrying thing, and it was great. And so then we all walked like some kind of a protest march toward the elegant Rose Room, and I yelled it in a loud voice, table for 27, you know. and the man at the maitre d' was a very crabby guy in a tuxedo, and he thought, what kind of a wacko Indian march is this now? This is the 60s, you know, coming in off the street into my Rose Room, not a chance. And so he mumbles, reservation? I said, no, they're not all from reservations. You know, some of them just live around Manhattan here. Anyhow, many years later, in 1985, I sang Take an Indian to Lunch this week in the Opera House of the Kennedy Center. It was a black tie affair with all the Indian tribes represented, and it was all the Indian leaders of America, and Mrs. Reagan was there, and quite a lot of people. You know, first nighters from Washington. It was a lovely evening, and Martin Sheen introduced me, and Lauren Green played the other part. And anyhow, at rehearsal, this Indian trombone player came up out of the orchestra pit and said, Mr. Freeberg, I'm Chief Russell Moore. You probably don't remember me, but 21 years ago, you took me to lunch at the Algonquin. And then he said, you remember that little papoose on my wife's back? Here's what he looks like now. And he pulled out this beautiful picture of this young American Indian soldier, sergeant in the Army.
Nice story. Nice story. One of the times that I push my remote control button is one of these when one of these soppy ads come on, one of these heartwarming ads that has very soft light, sort of a star filter on it, sort of a Vangelis kind of music score, and it turns out to be for a wine or a phone company. are you ever going to do a parody of one of these soppy heartwarming ads that's now out and around?
Possibly.
Have you been thinking about it actively? Or?
Not actively, but, you know, I've done a few parodies of soap operas. John and Marsha was a parody of soap operas, my record. And then for the Kaiser Aluminum Foil Company, I once did a parody of the soap opera genre, and it was called Kaiser Aluminum Foil Salesman Faces Life. And this poor man couldn't feed or clothe his family because the mean old grocer wouldn't stock Henry Kaiser's aluminum foil. And that went on every week. The episode would change, and I had Jim Amici as the announcer, who was Don Amici's brother. He was the most famous soap opera announcer in the 50s. And but I know exactly what you're talking about. I think probably it's time for me to do something like that.
Well, I'll look forward to it.
Go ahead.
I want to ask you about the sound effects men that you had on your records, and they both worked for Jack Benny, Bill James and Gene Twombly.
Yeah, well, that's right. I used a number of sound men, but those are the guys that that I used quite a lot. And Bill James was from Gunsmoke. And when I did my CBS radio series, I inherited Bill James from Gunsmoke and Gene Twombly from the Jack Benny show. And he was just a footstep expert, and He taught me how to walk, really. You know, by the time I was doing that show in 1957, I had pretty good mic technique, and from having worked in radio and so forth, and I was not a bad sound effects man, but this man was a virtuoso, and he taught me how to walk like one man and two men and actually three men, and I can do that now. I can also walk like a woman and walk like a teenager.
Are these just technical effects, or is it in the style of what would you use for the sound effects for the shoe sounds?
What would I use for the shoe sounds? Mm-hmm. I sit there in the studio late at night after most of the people have gone home and nobody there but my wife in the booth, who is my producer, and pull on these 12D Bally boots with a hard leather heels that I used only for walking, and I find the proper surface. Usually like a hard floor. Linoleum is okay, and sometimes I put down a board of masonite, and I walk on marble or whatever, and we put the mic down there. I still like to work on the 44B, the diamond shake mic, but the Sennheiser, whatever. I get it down there, and I just walk, and that's it. I walk on, so you don't have to fade me on and off. I can walk on mic and walk off, and it's just... It'd be easier if I could put my boots on now and show you what I mean, but on this book tour, I don't have my boots with me. But anyhow, every time I put them on, I think about Gene Twombly and how he taught me how to do this. Also, I can run up and down stairs, even though I'm just walking on a flat surface.
Your father was a minister. Do you feel that you're also in a similar calling? You have a public pulpit?
Yes, I actually do. I always thanked my dad for not forcing me into the traditional forms of ministering, but when you can make people laugh and not take themselves so seriously, you are indeed helping them get through life, and according to my friend Norman Cousins, you are in fact helping to heal them. And do you know about the book that Norman Cousins wrote healing himself?
Yeah. So why for you does it only hurt when you laugh?
Why is that the title of my book?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's an old joke, actually, and I can't remember whether it's my joke or not, but in 1956, I wrote an article for Collier's Magazine, and that was the title of an article I wrote that they had asked me to write on censorship, and I talked a lot about the problems I'd had with the lawyers at Capitol Records and the censors on radio and so forth. And the joke actually went, there's a man standing there with a spear through him, and some said, that must be terrible for him. And he said, no, actually, it only hurts when I laugh, you know. Not much of a joke, but it occurred to me that when I laughed is when I frequently got into trouble with censorship and lawyers, later on in advertising, clients, people trying to get me not to do something that I felt I wanted to do and needed to do in order to communicate with people.
Well, I want to thank you very much for plunging ahead with all that.
Well, anyway, I'm resilient. I'm resilient, man. I'm a survivor. The way I feel, I haven't even started yet with the things that I want to do.
Well, thanks very much for coming in on Fresh Air today.
Thank you, Sedge.
Stan Freberg's new autobiography is titled It Only Hurts When I Laugh. It's published by Times Books. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with theologian Harvey Cox. He went from being an obscure Baptist minister to an international celebrity in 1965 with the publication of his book, The Secular City. Cox is now a professor at Harvard and the author of many books that explore the meaning of religion in contemporary culture. I hope you can join us.
Messieurs, I want you should assist me later in this song, no? When I give you the signal, say, c'est bon, like that.
C'est bon, like that.
Pardonnez-moi, messieurs, just say c'est bon, forget it like that.
C'est bon, forget
it
like that.
No, just say c'est bon, period.
C'est bon, period.
Stop the music.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. I'm here from San Francisco for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. Ward Just was a star foreign correspondent for The Washington Post who threw over reporting after his time in Vietnam to write novels. On today's show, Ward Just tells us why he won't let himself or the reader get bogged down in facts. And besides, if your subject is Washington intrigue, then pure fiction is the better medium to tell the truth. Also today, rock historian Ed Ward plays us some songs that grew out of a British fashion statement in the 60s, the music of the mods. And book critic John Leonard reviews Rat King, Michael Dibdin's new detective novel set in Italy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Congressional leaders from both parties went to the White House today for their first meeting with President Bush since he took office. The main topic of conversation was how to proceed on budget negotiations. All parties were pleased with the tone of the meeting, even though they discussed no specifics. We get more from NPR's Jim Angle.
President Bush won't put his cards on the table until he addresses both houses of Congress February 9th, but he is continuing efforts begun just after the election to fashion a cooperative working relationship with Congress, a necessity since it is controlled by Democrats. House Speaker Jim Wright said the House will move quickly once Mr. Bush has outlined his proposals.
We have agreed that we will give it our immediate, urgent, full attention. And we will give it our sympathetic consideration, that we will accommodate all that is possible to accommodate in good conscience.
The president did propose a series of weekly meetings between administration officials and congressional leaders and members of the relevant committees. Congressional leaders were pleased with the spirit of cooperation the White House is seeking, and all said they were pleased that President Bush is taking an active role in the discussions. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
A revival of the controversy over Dr. Lewis Sullivan's position on abortion has threatened to disturb an otherwise calm beginning to the Bush administration. Some members of Congress say Bush's choice to head the Department of Health and Human Services told them he does not want to see the Supreme Court overturn a decision allowing abortion. That is not the view of the president and his many pro-life supporters. Despite the latest flap, congressional leaders say Sullivan is likely to win confirmation. Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady today told the Senate Finance Committee that the Congress should move cautiously in addressing the wave of buyouts and takeovers in corporate America. NPR's John Idstey has more.
Lawmakers are worried that the takeovers, which are being done mostly with borrowed money, create huge debt burdens for many companies. The concern is that if the economy slips into a recession and profits shrink, companies might fail because they're unable to make debt payments. Secretary Brady said he shared the concern about the levels of debt being taken on.
This system has arisen during a time when we've had pretty good times. So we haven't really tested whether it's a good idea to capitalize our corporations with such high degrees of debt in leaner times.
But Brady said there's not enough data yet to determine if overall the wave of takeovers and buyouts is harmful. So he suggested the Congress continue to study the issue, but not act in any way that might compromise the competitiveness of U.S. companies. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee begins hearings tomorrow on the nomination of John Tower as defense secretary. The toughest questioning is expected to center on the Pentagon's request for higher military spending. The former Texas senator, who supported military budget increases before he left Congress in 1984, must now back the Defense Department's demand for more money, despite promises by President Bush to cut the federal deficit. Episcopal leaders today announced that Reverend Barbara Harris has been approved to become the first woman bishop in the history of the Anglican Church. The Episcopalian Diocese of Massachusetts says that a majority of bishops who head the 118 dioceses across the country confirmed Harris's election. She's to be consecrated February 11th in Boston. The 58-year-old Harris will serve as assistant to Massachusetts Bishop David Johnson, who oversees the nation's largest Episcopal diocese. The stock market today regained the last of the 508 points lost 15 months ago in the Black Monday crash. The Dow Jones Industrial Average surged 38 points to close at 2256.43. Advances led declines 2-1 on volume of 191 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the early 60s, narrow lapels, skinny ties, pointy shoes, Italian suits, and dark glasses costumed an army of young British rebels known as the Mods. Their battle with the Rockers in Brighton in 1964, and documented in the movie Quadrophenia, brought about the end of the Mod movement. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says the Mods influenced both sides of the Atlantic more than once.
This is a mob world. This is the mob world.
It was 1977, and the latest word from Britain, which was still reeling under the impact of the punks, was that there was a mod revival. This must have been a relief to the people who thought that punks' anarchy was a threat, and it was a definite boon for the kids on both sides of the Atlantic who'd missed being mods the first time around. But it must have confused those old enough to remember the first wave, because when it started out, at least, mod wasn't a musical movement. Still, to the extent Americans know about mods, they know it through rock and roll. But at first, mod was just a style, an attitude. According to British pop historian George Melly, mods began to appear in London in early 1962, a very small group of young working-class boys who formed a small, totally committed little mutual admiration society totally devoted to clothes. Melly went on to say that it was not so much overt homosexuality as narcissistic. Girls were irrelevant. The little mods used each other as looking glasses. They were as cool as ice cubes. But because they were cool, they attracted all sorts of kids who saw in mod a secret society they could buy into. John Stephen, a tailor on an obscure short street in Soho called Carnaby Street, had some rather avant-garde ideas about men's clothes, which he'd sell off the rack or do up for you personally. Since Carnaby Street was in Soho, it had lots of dank cellars for rent, and soon the mods had their own clubs.
Ah, earthquake, child, earthquake! Shaking Orange Street, this music will beat. Sure. Let go. You see, tired. They want pop. Look how your face look like one of them old GOS boss. You're not hearing your spear and your front wheel puncture. You see, Orange Street is the music street. And that's the street that sells the beat.
Blue Beat, a Jamaican music imported for homesick immigrants in London, was one of the preferred soundtracks for mods because you wouldn't sweat up your suit dancing to it. Anyway, you might have to have it altered to meet next week's fashion dictates. But another preferred mod recreation was taking diet pills, amphetamines, and that required speedier music provided by some people who dressed almost as well as the mods themselves. Tamla Motown, as it was known in England, was the first American black pop music generally available there because of Motown's deal with London Records, and the mods made it their own. Naturally, it wasn't long before an entrepreneur got the idea that the mods should have their own bands, never mind that none of them had any inclination in that direction. A businessman in his 40s named Helmut Gordon had been introduced to a band in need of a backer, and their lead singer was sort of a mod. Gordon gave them a name, the High Numbers, helped them adapt a song they were already performing so it contained a mod buzzword, I'm the face, meaning I'm the guy others copy, and sent them into the studio. The band hated it, and so did the mods. It didn't sell because, as the band feared, people knew it was a rewrite of Slim Harpo's Got Love If You Want It. But they liked the idea of being the mods' band, so they wrote an original mod anthem for their next record.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
My generation. Take my generation, baby.
The stutter imitated a guy stoned on pills, and the sentiments were mod all right. But they were also universal enough that soon The Who, as they now called themselves, could forget about being mods and start being stars. Anyway, by the time My Generation came out, the mods were evolving into hippies. Carnaby Street was a tourist attraction, girl mods like Twiggy appeared, and there were even other mod rock and roll singers.
Listen, everybody, everybody, especially you girls.
You girls.
Like to be left alone by the one you love, never phone. I love to holler.
Yeah, yeah,
my
yeah.
Friends sometimes say,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I believe that a woman should love that way.
Young Rod Stewart made his name as the Steam Packets' mod fashion plate. But by 1965, when that record was made, mod was uncool enough that it was only fit for derision at the hands of the master, Ray Davies.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best. 'Cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town, eagerly pursuing all the latest fads and trends. 'Cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion.
As usual with revivals, the new mods were modder than the old ones, and although they made some fine music with the Jam and the two-tone groups, they disappeared quicker. Oh well, this is the modern world.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. This is Fresh Air. After covering the Vietnam War in the mid-60s for the Washington Post, Ward just says he lost interest in day-to-day political reporting, so he turned to fiction. Since 1970, he's written 10 novels, several drawing on his years spent in Washington. His new novel, Jack Gantz, is set in the political arena of the 60s and 70s. The story follows Jack's rise in politics from Chicago ward politics to the U.S. Senate. In his review of Jack Gantz, our book critic John Leonard said that he couldn't think of another writer of Ward Just's quality who has made it his artistic business to imagine the whys and wherefores of the morality of politics. These days, Ward Just spends most of his time living in Paris. I asked him if he follows the ins and outs of Washington politics from France.
I will go, you know, days sometimes and never read anything that comes out of Washington, in part because most of it's so repetitive. I mean, rarely do you actually find something, except that as a citizen, you want to know. You want to know what George Bush's cabinet appointments are. I want to know that as a citizen. It has no implications for my writing life.
So you can write about characters in the 70s and the 80s, as well as in the 50s and 60s, and find that, for the most part, that'll work. You know enough about Washington to get the facts right.
I think so. You try to get the streets correct, and you try not to, you know, to have somebody in Georgetown on the wrong side of the river, but that's really all you need. Jack Gantz, for example, there isn't a fact in a carload in there. I think I've got somebody at one point sitting on the sixth floor of the executive office building, sort of looking down into the Rose Garden, and I was checking with somebody if that was actually true, and the guy said he thought it was, but he'd call up Washington to check, and I said, "Oh, don't bother," because it doesn't matter. If you take the premise of Gantz and you're reading and you get that far, it's about halfway through the book, and you all of a sudden find a guy on the sixth floor, and you happen to know that you can't see the Rose Garden from the sixth floor, you're going to read right over that. You ought to. I mean, if the novel should create a strong enough mise-en-scene of its own, I mean, a strong enough ambiance of its own, that once you get in it, you'll take any so-called fact or detail for what it is and not relate it to whether or not it is objectively true. In other words, if Jack sees it, it's true.
Right. And that is a change from your work as a correspondent for Newsweek.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. It's 180 degrees.
Yeah. Well, you have a description of Washington that describes both, I think, the political culture and the intersection with personal lives in a very nice way in Jack Gantz.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could read a bit to us of this.
Indeed. Besieged, we came to resemble the corporate world we had despised and derided. The city grew, the culture thickened, and the custodians multiplied, the government floating on a sea of debt. The world owed Washington a living. The film advanced, the reel accelerated, and in a minute I was in middle age, successful and conspicuous, a president's man. My minute. A congressman passed me along to a senator, an insider's insider, so thoroughly a product of the Senate committee system that he was nicknamed the Camel. I commenced an affair with the Camel's wife, a woman 10 years younger than her husband, who understood the city's routine and understood also the Camel's fierce enthusiasm for it. The Camel wanted to be a chairman, and that was all he wanted. Their married life had suffered, obviously. The Camel wanted one thing and she wanted something else, but that was often the case with two highly motivated people in a cautious, acquisitive city. She was a witty woman, filled with gaiety and rich. Her money had financed the Camel's political career. She was proud of that and proud of him. She was accustomed to having things her own way, and in that she was accommodated by her husband and the city's strange twilight mood. The affair flourished and we talked of marriage, but she would not leave him. She had put so much into their marriage, and he needed her. And what are your prospects, Jack?
A lot of your Washington novels have a sense of ordinariness about them. I mean, in other words, there's no sort of 7 days in May sort of crises that evolves. But they tend to have more sort of lubricious deal-makings, behind-the-scenes action. From your experience as a reporter there in Washington, as an editorial writer for the Washington Post, is this your sense of what really goes on? There's just sort of an accretion of events?
What's interesting in Washington is the language that they use, and the language that they use not in press conferences but to each other. And it is always, or nearly always, a language of indirection. And if you are, to my mind, to get at Washington, no less than you try to get at political life in Philadelphia or commercial life in Paris or Detroit or Chicago, what gets to the heart of the life of a city are the more daily things.
You talked about this language of indirection that goes on. As a novelist, you need to have a great deal of precision in the sense of recording your own images and ideas. How do you cope with this issue of dealing with people who live and thrive on indirectness, yet you have to set forth a story that is direct and
clear? It's technically, it's the most difficult thing about trying to write a book about people who live part of their lives in the public glare. Because, I mean, just in choosing your characters, this has to be done very carefully so that the minute you wheel somebody on stage, that immediately they say, oh, that's, you know, he's talking about Kissinger there, he's talking about George Bush someplace else or some congressman or senator. And once that happens, the novel will fall as if you'd put a 500-pound dead weight in it. It'll absolutely sink from sight. But the minute you try to step over, what I'm trying to say is you must create your own characters. You cannot find these characters on the front page of the daily newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You worked as a foreign correspondent. That was almost your first job in journalism, as I recall. And you were sent off to various parts throughout the Caribbean. Somebody told a story that when you were in the Dominican Republic to verify that Trujillo was as nasty as everyone said, that you actually dug up bodies in a mass grave to prove that?
Yeah, it's funny. I hadn't thought about that story in years. It was true. I was tipped off. And I was tipped. A man said, if you go to a bridge and gave the coordinates of the bridge and you dig, you're going to find dead people there. And it was a slow news day. So I went with a friend of mine. We got him, rented a car, and drove out to this bridge and started digging, and it's true. There they were. I hadn't. You really bring that back. I hadn't thought about that in years and years and years, but it's true. They called me a hard digging reporter after that.
Oh, gee.
I know. Couldn't resist.
There was a But there was another time in your life when you were sent to Vietnam by the Washington Post from, 65 to 67 that was had a little more effect on you. You've said it roiled your waters. What does that mean?
I used to sort of give an explanation that had to do with facts and illusions and all that nonsense, and all that's partly true, too. But what it really was some kind of was a passage. I was one of those people. I fit into the war in Vietnam. It was the sort of war that I was able to cover. I don't know why I was able to plug into the particular craziness of it somehow. I mean, maybe because I think my strength as a reporter was always, I had a particularly good sense of ambiguity. And at the time that I was there, 66 and 67, the war was rich in ambiguity. And if you had a touch for that, and also a little sense of irony and paradox, there was more than you can ever write.
One last question here, if I could. You're the son and grandson of newspaper publishers, and you've also worked as a reporter yourself. How do you think they'd view your life, having sort of abandoned the daily day pressures of newspaper business? You think they'd say, terrific, Ward, you did exactly what we'd always hoped to do?
A very interesting question, and I think that they would absolutely have preferred me to stay in the newspaper business. I think there is no doubt about that.
Was it their attitudes about fiction or the writer's life?
No, their attitude was about the newspaper that they owned, which they absolutely loved like they loved a child. And I still occasionally see them shaking their finger at me, you know, saying, why have you done this terrible thing to go off and write these novels when you could be sitting in Waukegan, Illinois, publishing a newspaper? And it's given me a thought or two, you know, over the years. Not such a large thought as to make me really basically question the decision of what I did. But it's true, you know, you have a kind of a family tradition like that, and it always has a meaning to you.
Well, Ward Just, thank you very much for coming and being with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Novelist Ward Just. His new novel, Jack Gans, is published by Houghton Mifflin. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later here on National Public Radio is All Things Considered, and host Alex Chadwick has come down from the NPR newsroom. I understand reports from afar in the news today.
Yes, we have a report from our man Tom Gelton, who's in El Salvador, where the rebels there have made a new offer to the government. They will desist some of their war against the government and participate in the national elections that are scheduled for March if the government will agree to move back those elections about 6 months or so. A report from Tom Gelton coming up on that. Also, a report from Kabul in Afghanistan, where the Soviet troops are withdrawing to meet their deadline of the middle of February to be out of the country, and things look shaky for the government and the people left behind.
Thank you, Alex. That's what's coming up on All Things Considered here on National Public Radio. The city of Perugia in Italy is perhaps best known for its chocolates. It's now also the setting of a seedy crime network in Michael Dibdin's new detective novel, Rat King. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Michael Dibdin has published a previous novel, the last Sherlock Holmes story, but he's new to me and a wonderful surprise. The jacket of Rat King tells us that he grew up in Scotland and Northern Ireland and edits books for Oxford University Press. Why, then, is his police detective an Italian? Displaced from Venice to Rome, busted from the crime squad to a desk job after the murder of Aldo Moro, the Christian Democratic politician and former prime minister. And why is this detective, Aurelio Zen, now sent so mysteriously to the hill town of Perugia, where a kidnapped industrialist is still missing, even though the usual ransom has been paid, and the victim's family is behaving so oddly, and a communist magistrate suspects a setup, a conspiracy he calls the Rat King? Well, once we get to Perugia, it doesn't really matter why Michael Dibdin sent us there, instead of Edinburgh or Belfast or Oxford. Like everywhere else in the modern world, Perugia is corrupt from its bedrooms to its courtrooms. And like every other detective in modern mystery fiction, Zen is a citizen of ambiguity. His mother is impossible, his lover is American, and Zen himself would much rather never leave the bright lights of the big city, any big city. Quote, he didn't much care for nature in the raw. It was messy and wasteful, and there was too much of it. When he should be thinking about Aldo Moro, Zen is dreaming instead about Leon Trotsky and Nazis and Jews and Franciscans and metastasizing capitalisms in the East and West. He discovers incest, but it has nothing to do with the case. He comes into the possession of pornographic photographs being used for blackmail, but neither do they have any bearing on the case. The great weakness of paranoia, he tells us, is that it cannot take chance into account. Zen's considerable wit is wasted on a multitude of villains, all of whom are lying to him, and to all of whom he will in his turn lie, after which, for the wrong reasons, he will be promoted. Even though the industrialist is dead, the killer has escaped, the system abides in its greed and cynicism, and Zen's lover is going back to America to eat hamburgers. The Rat King, we are told, is not a great big super killer rat. It is instead many rats, forced to live in a too small space, grown together in a knot of their own tails, a solid, squealing, biting, spitting, lashing mass of vile survivors of their own trap, each responding automatically to any threat to any other. It's mere bourgeois adventurism, explains the communist magistrate, to think that conspiracies of powerful interests can be defeated by individual efforts. The Rat King is self-regulating. The strength of each rat is the strength of all. The system can only be destroyed politically, by collective action, a stronger system, close quote. The Rat King, Dibden seems to be suggesting, is middle-class family life and Italian politics and the modern world. Have another cappuccino. God is dead, but the mystery novel certainly isn't.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Rat King by Michael Dibden. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. When writer and Polish emigre Eva Hoffman first came to North America, her Canadian teacher made her change her name from Eva to Eva and then told her to sit on her hands because she gestured too much when she spoke. On the next fresh air, Eva Hoffman relates the pain of every immigrant, struggling to learn both how to speak the language and how to understand the culture in which it's spoken. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new releases from an invigorated Cleveland orchestra. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg traces the roots of the word Hoosier. Hoosiers might be pained to learn how close it is to an Alabama lizard or Nebraska bug eater. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.